Congratulations. You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Waswas.
We're getting right into it again this week, Maysoon.
Yes.
And we just have an interview. We're blasting into it.
Right,
we're not going to talk about Game of Thrones or any other stupid bullshit. Okay.
Come on.
So we have today.
Or are we?
We could.
She ain't
I might cut it if we do. Anyhow, we are talking to independent curator and beyond, Astria Superak.
Am I beyond independent or beyond curating?
All things.
You're beyond. You're just beyond.
Yeah. Do you have other signifiers or, I mean, you know, titles you'd like to throw in?
Titles. Mm-hmm. a little Game of Thrones reference there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dang.
Okay, we're in the middle of a heat wave out here. I saw today it is the high in Pittsburgh is 78 degrees.
Pittsburgh, California.
Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So you were in Pittsburgh. You were curating the Miller Gallery?
It was the Carnegie Mellon's Contemporary Gallery. Yeah, that's right. I was there for 6 years. I was the director and the curator. And it's a 3-floor, 9,000 square foot contemporary art space.
God damn.
3 full-time staff members.
And you had one of the shows.
Including me.
Was it there that was the like retrospective of the Yes Men?
Yes, I curated that. I opened that in Portland, Oregon first, though, and then brought it to Carnegie Mellon, and then also brought it to England.
How was that like? What was it like working with them?
Working with those guys.
They went to SFAI, didn't they? Or one of them did? Or
Portland is where Mike Bonanno went to school at Reed. And
is he the shorter
Jacques?
One?
Yeah. I'm not laughing because he's dramatically short. I just, it's hard to keep track.
Is
like,
he dramatically
fake
short?
Names and no,
right, of course.
Yeah.
And also, which you can't see, radio listeners, but there's a hand that was held at a certain height.
Very short, like maybe 2.5 feet off the ground.
Quite short.
Mm-hmm. But no, he is
so
average.
He's not
close to average height.
Yes, the average American male is 5'8", I believe.
That sounds right. Get out
that
of
sounds
here.
Right. Okay, and then the tall one. Who's
Jacques.
Also the gay one, right?
I do not call him that.
Oh, right.
if that helps you recall.
I remember because he was like a computer programmer, right? And he put this like gay bug Easter egg in SimCopter.
Oh,
where
whoa.
Like there was like some cheat code or something you could put in, and then all these bikini guys would come out
dancing.
Yeah.
Wiggling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
They rule. Did they pull any stunts,
any
like
hoaxes,
as part of the show?
Well, there were a few projects that would come out at the time of the opening. We also brought it to Texas.
Oh, that's
so there's
a good
like,
place.
There's a lot of touring with shows that I've produced. So there were things that were just really well timed.
Did they do like the polar bear prank or like what was it?
The Halliburton, Halliburton Surviva Balls were being employed a lot during that time. And as part of the show, one really fun part that we worked on was a giant mural that would be in each of the spaces that was based off of like the, you know, the safety cards in an airplane.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's got these little simple diagrams. So there's a diagram of how to employ a Surviva Ball, which is
it's like an inflatable
like,
suit.
Yeah, to survive the apocalypse. And so in that little instruction card are ways for you to suck the lifeblood and energy out of like whatever's left in the world, like a deer. And you can like jump out of your skyscraper business office in order to survive, and bounce around. So we created this scene that was this based off of that those simple images, but like kind of a more full fleshed out apocalyptic scene. 3D jumping instructionals with like 3D wooden arrows with the survive balls like hanging off the ceiling.
I love that.
It was fun.
Are they still doing it, right?
Yes.
I saw the Lands documentary that they put out. It seemed like it was kind of hard for them to keep going because of the shorter one.
Mike?
Like had kids and a family and stuff and was
many kids. So Mike, I just saw him maybe a couple weeks ago. He was in San Francisco briefly. He was telling me about a few projects that are coming up.
Do you want to endorse anybody in the Democratic primary?
You know, I feel like it's too early for me to really pay attention. I want the field to narrow down because I really pay attention to, I spend a lot of time like paying attention to politics every day, and the field's too big.
It's massive, huge. 24 yeah. people.
Has anyone dropped out?
Not yet.
Not yet.
Mm-hmm. Not that I know of.
Here's a Pittsburgh contrast.
Oh, yeah, please tell me everything.
It's fucking Pennsylvania, and they only give you the day of to vote.
Oh.
Yeah. No early voting whatsoever.
No. Wow. No mail-in vote.
No mail-in vote?
Wait, what, not even like an absentee?
Probably an absentee, but it's you aren't like reminded, here's how to do it. Here's yeah. You don't get your ballot in the mail.
Jesus Christ.
Yep. I mean, it's not a surprise. It's swing yeah. state.
No wonder.
Usually, often, Republican a lot.
What do you think is going to happen in 2020? Do you think Democrats will get Pittsburgh back? Right now on the betting markets, it's like about a 63% chance.
It sounds like you know more than I do at this point.
But you know people who are still there, right?
Yeah.
I don't know that many people in Pennsylvania.
But Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, the biggest cities, the most diverse cities in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
Almost always blue, yeah.
Okay, so then also, you're from Southern California, right? Are you from L.A.?
That's right, yeah.
And then, so as you were growing up there, were you a punk as a kid?
I was involved with the Riot Grrrl movement in the 90s.
Right on. Because then you curated the show that was at YBCA, but it traveled around, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Alien She, which I loved.
With CeCe Moss.
Yeah.
Before, we actually put the exhibition together before she landed at YBCA.
Oh, crazy.
Is that right?
Yeah. Oh, okay. Alien She was an exhibition about the lasting impact of the punk feminist movement, Riot Grrrl, on a generation of artists.
Right on. And you had, like, Stephanie Sahuko and, like, who else? Ray Carlin. Yeah,
Ginger Brooks Takahashi.
Yep. LJ
Roberts. Yeah.
With the like crocheted chain link fence.
Yeah.
Which I love that
first
piece.
Shown at SOEX.
Oh, no shit.
And was part of their thesis project.
That's wicked.
As well as the...
That's right.
Beautiful banner that they knitted that was the way that they came out to the world and to their mom by going to the tallest building in the town that they lived in Vermont and like unfurling that out the church
so
church steeple.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So then when you were putting that show together, was it kind of like drawing from like your youth kind of?
Yes. So I had started working on that exhibition, I don't know, like maybe 2010 or so, like researching artists, trying to think through it. And at some point I realized that based on like the subject, the way Riot Grrrl was put together, that it didn't make sense for that show to come out of like a single curator, like to come out of like one person putting it together, but it'd be better if it was through a dialogue. And a colleague and a friend had recommended CeCe Moss, who was perfect and was really amazing to work with. And she also had a different experience of Riot Grrrl than I did because she was in the Bay Area. She's a little younger. She's more of a musician. I mean, she's a musician. so that's where the beginnings of that exhibition. Oh, also, at the time, there weren't too many books, and I don't think there were, and there weren't too many documentaries that were out about Riot Grrrl at the time. So people still had this conception of Riot Grrrl as being like mostly a music, like a sub-genre of music. And one thing that CeCe and I had noticed in our careers as we became adults is that a lot of people that we knew in the movement had gone on to become artists and educators and activists and, you know, people who are still creative and still political. So we were interested in, like, that impact on artists because that hadn't been talked about, even though we're seeing it as, you know, in our careers. And then also how Riot Grrrl had been flattened as a movement that only like a dozen white cis girls from the Pacific Northwest were involved with. And so a really key part of our research, which was in the like archive section or the beginning section of the exhibition was showing like this movement, which still continues to today, but involved like this, you know, a huge demographic, people who are then or now identify as genderqueer and trans. Mm-hmm. It's in 26 different countries that we were able to find of where people are, where chapters are like call themselves Riot Girl or connected to Riot Girl. So there's like recent chapters in Malaysia and Turkey.
Hell yeah. Places. Wicked.
There's always going to be people who are like, no, it's only 6 white girls. Like, despite our experiences and others. Oh, and that's a part of like a couple parts of the exhibition that was part of our research was creating the Riot Girl chapters map. Google Riot Girl map and it'll come up. And the Riot Girl census, where you can hear directly from people who are involved with about their experiences with Riot Girl.
And you guys like gathered a ton of ephemera and like
that's right,
people zines and
yeah,
DIY stuff.
Did Riot Girl start in the West Coast? Is that was there like a central point?
There were two nodes on the West Coast in Olympia, Washington, and on the East Coast in Washington, D.C.
Okay, but when you were in the midst of Riot Girl as a youth,
yes,
did you fight people physically? Spitting on people?
Moshing, yeah.
I didn't.
Really?
No. I'm afraid I'd have like an asthma attack.
Oh.
In the mosh pit. Yeah. Asthma attack in the mosh pit. There's probably an album called that.
I love that.
No, but I was a part of a lot of protests and other things.
Oh, right on.
I mean, Riot Girl in part was created because there was like so much machismo in the punk scene, including the mosh pits. But when I remember when I was like a preteen teen, there was like a lot of fighting between like not like. Uh-huh. There was like the, what's it called now? It's so ridiculous now. Like there was like the neo-Nazis and then the non-racist skinheads.
Oh, okay.
Which anyone would not be able to tell unless you really knew right, like now. What colors the suspenders were. Like,
it's so true.
Always like fighting and.
Do you think that violence is ever justified?
Yes.
Okay, you also had a show that...
We don't need you to go into that.
No, you don't need to elaborate.
There's so many kinds of violence, people.
Okay, did you also do a show about fans of the Steelers football team, the Pittsburgh Steelers?
That's right.
She did, and I'm excited about you to talk about sports and art. I'm only saying that as like we're in the middle of like NBA finals right now, and it's really serious time for all of us Bay Area basketball fans.
So before we get to that very quickly, I like that your questions are in the form of like, did you or did you not curate this?
Yes or no. You're on the spot.
I heard it from a reliable source.
So I've done a lot of sports related programming over the years, and the Whatever It Takes exhibition, which was at Carnegie Mellon, and people did ask for us to tour it, but it was so deeply about Pittsburgh that didn't make sense. Mm-hmm. But I co-curated that with John Rubin, who is an artist who used to live in San Francisco.
Was that one of the most like well-attended shows?
You know, the biggest attended shows you have actually listed all of them. It was Yes Men show. We like ran out of capacity and couldn't get more people in the room.
Wow.
Holy shit. Like for the talk, the fire exits were like open with people standing out into the stairwell.
Wow.
So the Yes Men show, we had incredible attendance. The Steelers show, which people like Steelers fans would come into town from Florida or wherever.
Hell yeah, that's
for
what
the
I
exhibition
would
and a game.
Yep.
Whoa. And they would call us to be like, just confirming your
Are
hours.
You open? Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you partner with the Steelers? Like, were they kind of like corporate partners or no?
They were not. No, it was an
unauthorized
collaboration.
I actually really hate sports, but I love Pittsburgh. So.
Okay, so that's a typical like in the art world. There's this idea that sports and art are this really hard division.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
But not in Pittsburgh.
Hey,
hell yeah!
Pittsburgh. So, okay, so. John and I had lived in a lot of different cities, and we had never seen such a like rabid fan base for a sports team as we had in Pittsburgh. So that's part of why we put the exhibition together. So the fan base for the Steelers cuts across racial lines, gender. It's got the highest female fan base of the NFL, at least at the time that we put the exhibition together. Class, like your bus driver and your doctor are both Steelers fans. The anarchists in Pittsburgh are Steelers fans, many that I knew. A lot of artists, a lot of queer friends are Steelers fans. So the reason, the most talked about why this is the case, is because at the time that Pittsburgh's economy was tanking in the 70s with the steel industry dying out, the Steelers football team was like on a roll and winning a lot of Super Bowls. So there was this economic exodus of, you know, couldn't get a job anymore, were laid off their mill jobs. At the same time, like, the team also very cannily presents themselves as like mirroring the values of their working class base in Pittsburgh. So, you know, being named after the main industry in town, being owned by one family in its entire history.
Ooh.
The Rooneys. So the show included various manifestations of how Steelers fans create their own identity in combination, intertwined with the identity of the team. So we moved an entire basement fan cave into the gallery. So we built out like the studs for the walls, but left it open so you could see through. And we also had to increase the pathway because it was very small, made for one person to walk through, so it'd be ADA accessible in the gallery. So the fan, Denny DeLuca, is a chef in the daytime, a super fan all the time, and constantly is, actually, he also chefs at night. He actually has late hours, and that's how we met him. He's like, I'm getting off at 11 p.m., off of work at 11 p.m., and can you come over? So anyway, he has tons of handmade and altered objects just hanging off the ceiling, on the walls, bits of like past stadiums that the Steelers used to play in his cave. And one awesome thing, when we were talking about him, we had read about him online, or like, is there any possibility, you know, how are we going to approach it? And he actually, when we first met with him, he was like, it would be great if other people could see what I've made, like, it'd be great if this was in the gallery. And and the reason being is he has like three seats from the old Steelers stadium, Three Rivers, in his room, and he auctions them off at church each week that there's a game. So three people from his church
can join him,
can go into his awesome, amazing cave and watch the game with him.
I love that.
And then there's like a bunch of other things. Like, we went to all the tattoo parlors in Pittsburgh and asked for their Steelers related tattoos. And we created these walls. And then we also made temporary tattoos of other people's tattoos, so you could put them on your body, like,
that. So
with their hair and nipples and moles as well.
What happened after? Did you have like a team of preparators go in and get all of it? And then,
we did, of course.
Wow. And then did they put it all back?
Yes.
Wow.
We brought it back.
Damn.
But he had already been, like, during the duration of the exhibition, which we did have to extend because the Steelers made it to the Super Bowl that year.
Fuck yeah. That's good luck.
Yeah.
And we got even more calls of, like, I want to see the exhibition.
Yeah.
And, like, the New York Times were about the show. And it just blew up. So while the exhibition was going on, and like, Denny would come in and show people his room. There's more than just Denny's room. Focusing on that way too much. But he was working on more items. So we were like, how's this all going to fit back in? And one thing that we had made for him, which was like his like something he had really wished and like dreamt about, but didn't know how to make, was a photo for his ceiling. Because there's a bunch of things that were hanging off the ceiling, but not directly on the ceiling like there were on all the walls, which was a photo of fans in the stadium that he would replace each face with his friends.
Oh, cute.
And family. Yeah. So we...
I very relate to this person.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
In terms of obsession level,
it's
for
very,
sure.
The subtitle of the show is called Steelers Collections, Rituals, and Obsessions.
Yeah, so. For sure.
Yep.
So wait, are you a sports fan?
That is a question that I get frequently, actually.
Just curious.
I don't really think of myself as a sports fan. I'm not, I don't have an allegiance to any particular team. I'm interested in the culture of sports.
There were some other topics you brought up that I thought were would be worthwhile talking about. Specifically, I mean, I love the Art News's article about the museum workers' salary. Just sort of seeing all of that. Seeing that, do you know that?
Uh-huh.
That chart. Yeah. Seeing that chart populate from when they first posted it was like 200 entries, and now it's like almost 2,500 entries. My colleague and I have been talking a lot about, not recently, but when it first came out, just sort of was curious to see who was posting their salary and who wasn't. Yes. It seemed like a lot of preparators, a lot of like assistants, like interns, fellows, people who like just definitely don't get paid well at all. And like your higher senior curators, directors weren't posting.
Mm-hmm.
So that was
well,
sort of
duh, because they don't want everyone to know how fucking filthy rich they are.
They fucking should just do it.
And it's ridiculous because you can anonymize it. The whole thing is anonymous. You don't have to say exactly where. Knowing the number is what we need to know for us to negotiate fairer wages for everyone. Mm-hmm. So the people that I've heard from or heard about who are specifically not entering their data are men.
Oh.
And people at SF MoMA who are looking at the chart.
I'm sure they
are. Who are, you know, being helped by the information, being informed by the information, but don't want to contribute.
Why don't they want to contribute? Especially if they can do so anonymously.
I mean, Maysoon would have done it when she was still there.
Oh, yeah. I'll do it now for them. This is how much you get paid when you work there. It's shit.
Yeah, you should put your information in. I actually haven't heard the reasons. Mm-hmm. I'm assuming that they're worried people will figure it out, even though there's plenty of entries that are like West Coast large museum.
Right,
like,
for sure.
Or like Bay Area large institution. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many ways to make it not point to you exactly.
Yeah, and do it. It's going to be okay. There's 2,444 entries.
I know, especially now.
Okay.
If you haven't done it, do it now.
I'll put a link in the underworld. We will support you. Nothing bad will happen. Right? Like, there's not much
people
likelihood
like
of bad
SF
things.
MoMA isn't going to say, oh, we're going to drop your salary by 10,000 and give it to other people.
Right, exactly. I mean, it's easy enough with, like, you can get the high-paying people off of 990s. You know, like, that's easy enough to do. We all know Neil Ben Ezra is making something like
$900,000. 800,000 million billion.
Yeah, so we know that. I mean, that's all public information. You know what I mean? Like, go get it if you need to know it. Like, I could go and type that shit in right now for them. You know, like, here you go.
Well, that was a reason that I heard from one man at a museum, major museum, who was like, well, people can just get in my can just look it up. It's like, well, all of this information is in one spot. Like, this doesn't help.
Yeah.
Like, yes, if someone is trying to apply for a position in that institution, they might do that. But this is about the overall look at the art world.
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to just very quickly weigh in on the Bay versus LA?
Oh, yeah.
Because you're from LA. You now live in the Bay.
LA has a lot of great stuff going on, but you have to drive everywhere.
That's a fact. That's pretty much sums up the Bay versus LA segment over all of our years saying it. Okay. We got to get air conditioners out here.
You need a fan.
They
out
got
there.
Air conditioners in Pittsburgh, right?
But also, your heating bill in Pittsburgh is like in the hundreds every month of
in the
winter.
Yeah,
because it's old buildings with thin
poor insulation
windows. Yeah, and it gets cold.
Yeah, freezing.
So all the whole like the hype about being able to purchase a cheap home that you would still have to renovate, you lose a lot of money in terms of like heating costs.
Really though, compared to like having to pay market rate rent.
Okay,
in the Bay Area,
maybe
right?
Not, but then you're in Pittsburgh.
Never say bad things about Pittsburgh. I'm trying to get everybody to move there.
And why is that?
So they can vote election and have electoral power.
Oh,
we need
okay
to tip the scales.
Okay, I thought it was an actual personal interest in moving. It's not.
No, I'm planning on moving. In this, I'm going. I don't give a fuck. I'm at least going from like June to November 2020.
Do you know how long you have to live there to be a resident in order to
be online. We looked it up, Maysoon. You got to be there 30 days before 30. You got to be there 60 days before the election. 30 to establish residency and then 30 to be registered to vote before the election.
Yeah, 2 months is no big deal.
People get out there. It's beautiful. Right?
Go to Pittsburgh.
Yeah, it is a beautiful city, actually. It is in that, like, hot, humid belt, like D.C.
It's lovely. It's not?
I would assume that
it was. It's temperate.
Wait, I said it was.
Oh,
it
it's was. Got it is. Sunshine. Okay. It's got rain. It's got seasons.
It's like,
got
really hard to drive there because there's no grid.
But you're going to go in September, right? So it'll be fall. No, it's going to be
June to November. A bit, but...
Why the whole summer?
Gotta get out there and canvas and organize.
Oh, no, that's true. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you're going to be doing that. I think that's great. And yes, more people should do it. Long-term living in Pittsburgh, living as a person of color in Pittsburgh, I can't totally sign on to. But the election is sure super enough. Fucking important.
Yes.
Yeah. And
yeah, better than Erie, though, huh? Erie, Pennsylvania.
I've only driven through Erie. I mean, any middle part would not. Oh, I should shut up.
No, it's fine.
Okay, anyhow, I'm going to be cutting all this anyway. Okay, any other shout outs or.
Oh, yeah. Oh, wait. I wanted to mention some museums that don't get mentioned in the Bay Area.
Oh, yeah.
Like. There's a, okay, one of the great things about the Bay Area. Okay, so there's, you know, there's the whole ecology of art spaces with the museums that we all know that we've been talking about. Actually, we've only been talking about one. And then nonprofits, I've been here for years, decades. All the small spaces that are only here for like a year or two, some of them, I mean. And then the really specific spaces, including the Sake Museum, which is in a sake factory.
Straight up never heard of this in my life.
So it's
in the Bay Area?
Yeah. So it's in Oakland, I want to say, like close to the water. And they have all this old equipment to create sake from, you know, like a century or two. I can't remember.
Wow.
But like all these
had
weights.
No idea.
Yeah, it's great. And then you could do sake tastings. I mean, it's great as in it's like, you know, a space in a factory that they've set aside for all these displays. Like, so there's cool stuff. There's also, I know this is controversial to include Santa Cruz in the Bay Area, but, no, you know, it's loose. okay, so there's the Surfing Museum, which is in an
lighthouse.
Awesome.
I've been there.
Yeah, great.
I think I've been there. I think our friend of the show, Eli Thorne's, like, grandpa or great-grandpa is in it. That cool. is, yes, highly recommended.
Hawaiians created and brought surfing to the mainland.
Sure just, enough.
You know, in case you don't know.
Fuck yeah.
And then also in the Santa Cruz Mountains, there's a Bigfoot Museum.
Oh.
Smaller than this room. Very cute. Questionable stuff.
I love it.
I love that.
And then there is, like, the Chinese Historical Society of America Museum. Very long name. Mm-hmm. Has a lot of great stuff from about... the Chinese immigration to the U.S. and around the Exclusion Act, et cetera. So
is that also in Santa Cruz?
That's in San Francisco.
And there's always Kate's favorite.
Oh, the International Art Museum of America, which now is charging admission. So
you love it.
When I was telling someone I was going to be on this podcast, someone who doesn't listen to the podcast and doesn't listen to art podcasts, and was like, what's it called again? Hello, Pinecone?
Pretty much, yeah.
That could be like your spin-off pod for smaller, the short minis.
I wonder if
Hello,
you search
Pinecone.
Hello Pinecone, if it would link to us. We should get
I'll
that.
Put it in the metadata. Okay, listeners, I hope you're staying cool out there.
Good luck with that.
Good luck. Good luck to you, Astria, and thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
And as always, congratulations.